Well, tonight I wanted to speak a little bit about the unity of emptiness, wisdom, and compassion, which is really like the vast mystery at the heart of reality of our practice and not really understandable by conceptual thought. So talking about it's kind of useless. Anyway, a lot of talk hopefully pointing us in a direction of experiencing the truth, or at least opening to what's possible. Sometimes it's often can be felt, a meditator, not someone here, but a friend was expressing to me one time in a retreat that he was feeling like this, the experience, the ideas of emptiness, and then also the sense of the vast compassion that our actions in the world and the needing to respond and be engaged felt like two completely different realities. And you feel like it was very surreal, and so kind of bouncing back and forth between emptiness and cause and effect, the world of action. And you know, sometimes it can feel like that to our thinking minds, because the thinking mind, the kind of linear conceptual mind, unless yours is different, it's hard to hold these things, hold both aspects of how things are. There's a, I don't think I used this in my talk, from Thich Nhat Hanh about the thinking mind. He said, wisdom is not really learned from thinking. It arises through the long process of conscious awareness. Sometimes thought wisdom can be expressed through thinking, but mostly thoughts are too rigid and limited to carry much understanding. And I think in this case of this, it's sort of like that, but here we are with our thoughts. So sometimes, looking from the two points of view, these are two questions that come to my mind when my mind is speaking from one or the other stances. So from the stance, the limited stance when they're not together, of emptiness, you know, the question is like, what's the point? What difference does it make what we do when everything is a dream? You know, if it's all just a rainbow, ephemeral dream, does it really matter so much what we do? And then why are we suffering if it doesn't matter, right? And from the point of view of really connecting, acting, being a limited human being in this world, the question that comes up for me is, how do I continue to open, to keep my heart open, to be present in the face of so much suffering and confusion? Just take my own life, spread it out to friends, and then just read the news, you know, once. And how does one continue to open to that without drowning in despair or shutting down? And if the two modes of reality are distinctly different from one another, neither one of those really works. You know, they're incomplete. That's why the sense of the link of the emptiness and action in the world is compassion. And in a way, they're inseparable, although different angles, like two sides of one, I don't like to say coin, so materialistic, but two sides of whatever. So just talk a minute about the emptiness side, which we've been talking about a lot. And it's sometimes it seemed the emptiness of all phenomena, as I was talking about the other night, and as we've all been mentioning, everything comes together momentarily when the conditions are there and falls apart. There's no intrinsic self-reality in anything. And that's the place where it's all a dream. And that can be, at times, in moments of experiencing, it can be very just normal and freeing. But other times, it can be quite, it can engender fear or confusion or often people say, especially in terms of anatta, in terms of no self, it's just kind of some phrases that have been used to me are alien, like, you know, like an alien from another planet. Cold, indifferent, uncaring, disconnected, or why would I want to live like that? Everything's a dull gray uniformity, and what's the point if I'm practicing for that? Forget about it, right? And, of course, if we were practicing for that, probably none of us would be up here trying to share it with you, but it can feel like that at times. So I just want to just read a couple short things speaking to this, because it can be, it depends on where the attention is. Sometimes it can be freeing, and sometimes it's very jarring. From Dingo Kensi. The way we usually experience the outer world, our bodies, and our feelings is impure in the sense that we perceive them as ordinary, substantially existing entities. Our bodies, our feelings, the outer world. And from this erroneous perception come the negative emotions that perpetuate our suffering. However, take a closer look at all these appearances. You will find that they have no true existence. From a relative point of view, they appear as a result of various causes and conditions, like a mirage or a dream. But in reality, nothing that arises from causes and conditions has any true self-existence whatsoever. It's very clear, very complete, radical. In fact, there is not even anything to appear. There's nothing. As it is said, one who realizes emptiness is the true sage. So that's like kind of throwing down a radical point of view. It's all completely a dream, a mirage. And just noticing how that lands at the moment in your heart mind. Here's another short, the Chokinima, the elder brother of Soni Rinpoche, a talk I heard him give. He was referring to Shantideva having said this. I could not find the citation in Shantideva, but I'll trust that Chokinima knows what he's talking about. The Shantideva says, without Rigpa, without the view, without understanding the true nature of mind, our life becomes a series of happy and unfortunate events, and in the end is meaningless. I say it on purpose because I think, first, I love that, but I also think it can be quite challenging. So if you notice reactivity coming up, just notice that. What do you mean it's meaningless? He's saying without the view, without the wisdom of this ephemeral, empty nature, empty of any kind of self-existence. So that's strong, no? That's a strong statement. How are we left with that? It really can be kind of nihilistic. Not even depressing, but just how do we function from that? If that were all. And sometimes when, you know, the way our practice goes, our whole life, think of practice as our whole life, not just a retreat and not just formal meditation practice, but the understanding, the learning, all the aspects of our whole life on the path, our understandings and our insights kind of don't all grow evenly, if you know what I mean. So sometimes, if talking from this way of emptiness and compassion, sometimes the insights, the kind of gut-level experience into the ephemeral, empty nature are what are growing stronger. And there could be other times when the sense of action in the world and tuning into our motivations and the cause and effect of action seems stronger. They're not always equally balancing one another. So in terms of when the emptiness piece seems stronger, there can definitely be kind of a phase, hopefully it's only a phase, but something to look at, to notice when it's happening, when we really do fall into this sense of it is true that nothing has any intrinsic self-existence. It's not a metaphor that our life is like a dream. It's actually how it is from a point of view of emptiness. But if we stick there, that's really not enough. That's wisdom without the wholeness. As we know very well, the quotation from Padmasambhava is why my view is higher than the sky, the vastness of emptiness, higher than the sky. But my attention to my actions and their effects is finer than grains of barley flour. And true wisdom can't have one without the other. The deep understanding of emptiness doesn't take us into a nihilistic who cares, it doesn't matter. It actually, and this is what's amazing, is the natural effect, is the, not even opening into, but the natural response of the empty, mirage-like heart, mind, body, when confronted with any action in the world, will be one of metta, compassion, equanimity. It's just the truth of how it is. It's really lovely. Otherwise, we're lost. Padmasambhava again. The view is the most important thing. However, do not let your actions slip in the direction of the view. If it does, you will fall into the evil views of demons, prattling on about how goodness is empty, evil is empty. And have you heard that or read that sometimes with different kinds of teachings where it really doesn't matter what you do if you know it's all empty? And so this is really saying that's not the complete wisdom. That's not how it is. But don't let your view slip in the direction of action either, or you will be caught in materialism and ideology. You see what I mean? I'm talking about it. This seems very conceptual, but none of this understanding can come through concept. We can't think our way into it. So hopefully I'm just trying to point to, because we all have moments of experience of both of these. And I don't know how your minds are, but I know my mind and many people's minds I talk to has a tendency to want to figure something out and be linear and land in one truth or the other. It's like this, and we should be able to explain it. But it's the two, and it's not even two, but these two views together make how it is. It is a danger, this is from Nyosho Kempo, that we get caught in the view of emptiness. The view of emptiness is different from what I would call the cellular knowing, the cellular experience of moments of the ephemeral, fragile, non-graspable nature of everything in existence. But the view gets us really caught. From Nagarjuna, translated by Stephen Batchelor. Buddhas say that emptiness is the giving up of opinions. Believers in emptiness are incurable. Because we're believing in something that there's no way to prove and just caught there. Believers in emptiness are incurable. But the thing is, it's the natural response of the true, even just for a moment, the true recognition of the non-self, non-lasting nature of any moment, that the heart-mind is released from this obsessive self-referencing, from the me and other fixation, even if just for a moment it's released into tenderness, into compassion, into connectedness with life. Nyosho Ken. Someone who realizes that all phenomena are empty and realizes the non-existence of self or ego will naturally have spontaneous compassion for all sentient beings who do not realize this truth and who continue to suffer through delusion and clinging. And even if it's not that grand of a compassion, and imagine, you've all experienced, I certainly have, I know everyone I've talked to has, just moments, and it can be just a simple thing, when whatever's going on, you suddenly, the heart-mind just releases its tightness for the moment, and you open to this ephemeral fragility of life. The heavenly messengers that Ursula was speaking about last night, the examples in our own life that touch us all even immediately, even today, when that, not just an idea, but the reality of the non-graspable, ephemeral nature, the fragility of all life, of all experience, when we really open to that just for a moment, isn't the natural response of the relative heart-mind one of compassion, of metta, of tenderness? I mean, when we're really open to it, not a conceptual idea. It's all passing, it's all fragile, to hell with it anyway, I'm out of here. That's a thinking one. But when we really touch it, really let it in, and that's the experience of emptiness. It's not some idea. It's the, not even experience, but just in that moment, it's so clear. The conditions are coming together and going apart, and there's nothing here to hold, nothing lasting. This tenderness, even just for a moment, that's just what comes up. That's how our relative mind-body can express itself, can relate itself in action. Dingo Kensi Rinpoche. In fact, relative truth is inseparable from absolute truth. The profound realization of the empty nature of all things has never led anyone to believe that positive actions do not create happiness and negative actions do not cause suffering. Inseparable. I love this. Because when we can, you know, we read different things and we can pick and choose, and it can sound as though, you know, the understanding of emptiness is this high thing, and the so-called relative world of actions and cause and effect is somewhere we have to mess around in until we really, really understand it, and then we can escape from that. And, you know, it's not so. Where are you going to escape to? There's still a body and mind, even though they're completely ephemeral and ungraspable and conditions coming together and going apart in every moment. And still, as Dingo Kensi says, there's actions, and wholesome actions have wholesome effects in the heart-mind. Unwholesome actions bring pain and suffering in our heart-mind. Both are true. It's absolutely empty, ephemeral, and there's the world of cause and effect. How do we balance? How do we work with both of them? To me, it makes total sense that in the moment of, for lack of a better word, experience of emptiness, it's not like a thing, but just when the mind suddenly, again, stops grasping, you just, oh, right, there's nothing here. That whole sense of the obsessive self-referencing just vanishes then, right? You know that whole sense of me, I'm the center of everything? Has anybody noticed that? Yeah. And a few people have mentioned really seeing in a very refined way, maybe in a sitting or in a walking, just that sense of like a little point of me measuring everything else. Ever so subtly or incredibly grossly, it doesn't matter, but keeping doing it. But then in the moment of just touching that fragility, that nothing to grasp and no grasping happening, that obsessive self-referencing, that creator of self and other, just in that moment, it's not there. And so much energy mental heart energy is released from that obsessive grasping. It's released into responsiveness, engagement with whatever the particular action is that's required at that moment. It's just the natural effect of the release of all this me, me, you, me. What is it? It's just what's the next thing that needs to happen? It happens by itself. The Dalai Lama. The paradox is that although the drive behind our excessive self-focus is to seek greater happiness for ourselves, it ends up doing exactly the opposite. When you focus too much on yourself, you become disconnected and alienated from others. And in the end, you also become alienated from yourself. With too much self-focus, your vision becomes narrow. And with this, even a small problem appears out of proportion and unbearable. Have you ever noticed that? And when that goes away, there's not the sense of self in others. The whole situation is different. I give you a very little, simple example I've used before from years ago in my life. Very simple, though. I was traveling. I was probably 20 or something, traveling on an overnight train in India. And I had booked a sleeping berth. But I didn't know that you could have a ladies' car and book a berth in the ladies' car. I didn't know that. So I had a berth and it was in a compartment with, four berths, two uppers and two lowers. And the other three people were men, Indian men in there. And so, I had an attitude. But anyway, I didn't feel comfortable, let's put it that way. And so I was just lying on my berth. They were lying on theirs, and staring at me, which I felt, I was taking that as personal. But that's not even rude, that was just normal. But I was protection, but it was aversion. Filled with aversion. What are they doing in my car? These guys shouldn't be. I was really feeling a lot of negativity, a lot of separation, a lot of me and them. And really, they were just lying there. They did absolutely nothing. But we were all very separate. And this went on for a lot of the night. And something just shifted in me. I didn't know much Dharma then, so it wasn't anything like I said, now I should meet this situation with compassion and emptiness. I don't know. I was just lying there creating, suffering in my mind. And then at some point it just shifted. I said, well, this isn't my car. This is our compartment, And here we are all together. That's all I did. I didn't look at them. I didn't speak to them. I just kept lying there. But it shifted in my mind. Just, okay, this is just our car. And then in the morning, when the light comes up, people get up and you put up, and you sit on the benches. And all of a sudden, from four of us, there came to be 25 of us because their whole families came in, their wives and their kids. I mean, where were their wives and kids? I don't know. But their wives and kids and cousins and I don't know came in. And there's, 25 of us in the car. And it was all friendly. There's, when you stop at train stations and the chaiwalas and the little food people that come by selling stuff. So the men were buying things. Oh, taste this. This is our good country. This is jalebis. This is try the chai. Try the pakoras. And it was so friendly and so nice and just this sense of togetherness. And I still remember that because the power, looking back, from I don't want to say how many years later, looking back on the power of, in a minimalist way, a clear recognition without doing anything overtly. But the motivation, the understanding shifted. The sense of this obsessive self-reference and creating of alienation just went away. And the whole situation was met in a different way with friendliness and metta. It is just the natural effect of the heart-mind understanding, the non-separation, the fragility. It's just appropriate. We make the appropriate response. But then on the other side, when there's the sense of opening to connecting with others, but not from a sense of complete emptiness when we really are kind of not lost in suffering, but when we really are with open-hearted compassion meeting situations, it can arise quite the sense of that the suffering or the pain that we feel, whether it's our own one personal experience or a vaster one, it can really be overwhelming sometimes, can it? You ever experience just with our sincere intention of presence and care. And so many people will often say, and I say it myself, you know, how can I continue to open in this world, in this situation? You know, and that can be a personal situation of pain and loss and sorrow. It can just be at the moment, it can be reading the news every day. It can be just, you know, so many tragedies, so many disasters everywhere. Or it could just be you're feeling overwhelmed with your own illness. It could be anything. But there's times when that natural self-obsessiveness responds in the response of compassion, of just touching the suffering. And it's compassion is actually a beautiful state of heart and mind. It's not a suffering state of heart and mind, which is strange. It's really metta, that quality of open-hearted fullness of connecting without holding back. When that metta connects with the suffering aspect of any being, anything, it has the quality of compassion. But it's a beautiful emotion because it's not partaking of separation or aversion or clinging. It moves into when we're not, you know, when it's not too much, when we're not feeling overwhelmed and pulling away. It moves into, again, the immeasurable, the limitless space of the heart-mind. And so metta is a beautiful emotion because, I mean, not metta, compassion, metta too, but compassion, when it's real compassion, because, I have to say we, but there's no me there. There's not that sense of self and other, of alienation and needing something from outside. It's like, oh, this is how it is. Full open presence of heart mind with no resistance. It's like this now. And because there's that open presence without resistance, there's the possibility to recognize if there's an appropriate action to take. Because our vision isn't obscured by wanting or self-interest or aversion. But back to the question, you know, this is where compassion also needs the support of the wisdom of not self, of the wisdom of emptiness, or we do drown in it. We do get overwhelmed, of course, not to have some ideal, you know, okay, I really know I'm not, there's no self, so I should be able to open to all the suffering, you know. Okay, reality check, which is what? What's our reality check? Moment-to-moment mindfulness. What's happening now? What's happening now? I'm drowning. How can I possibly hold this all? You can't. I can't. Because it's not about a separate self holding anything. As soon as there is the separate self, we're going to hit our limit. And of course we will, much of the time. Not to think that's wrong, but just to recognize it and not try to override that with an idea of view that isn't really true. Just like the idea, the view of emptiness can take us into nothing matters, I can do whatever I want. The view that real wisdom would manifest as compassionate action no matter what, that isn't really in touch with the reality of what's occurring in this mind-body, can take us into a lot of suffering and trouble too. So, you know, wisdom of emptiness manifests as compassion, and it needs the compassion. The compassion, the fine attention to action and cause and effect also needs the wisdom for the vastness. So somehow I feel our path, my practice anyway, I've felt it my whole life, is somehow continuing to deepen in both aspects and finding how they balance. Because until we're completely awake, right, it's kind of a balancing act. something, it's just an image that I find helps me when I'm thinking about this. The image of the green Tara. I have a little green Tara statue at home, very similar to a Kuan Yin image, a bodhisattva of compassion. So the green Tara is, again, the sense of like the of wisdom and compassion coming together. So the statue, I have just a little sweet statue at home. So the green Tara is sitting there, with the face very serene, clearly in the sense of equanimity, wisdom, presence, meditation. But the eyes are opened. It's not pulled back and disconnected. The eyes are open. If you know the green Tara, her foot's always up, kind of resting up like this. But it's not a sense of, gotta go, gotta do something. It's totally serene and present and not looking for anything. But there's that sense of when a compassionate response is the obvious thing to do, that foot's ready and it just happens. You don't have to think about, should I? But it'll mess up my samadhi. I need to sit here. Okay, I'll go later. Or I'm just so tired right now. That's why I'm just so tired, But remembering also compassion includes the being here. But anyway, that to me, I have that little statue on my altar at home. And not that I don't just sit and analyze it, but it's just that sense of the unity of wisdom and compassion, of emptiness and compassion. Sometimes one's more obvious, sometimes the other. So yes, I've been saying how the compassionate response, the release of the self-grasping, is the natural effect, result of the deep, profound understanding of emptiness, of not self. And at the same time, in our formal specific practices and also in how we can live our life, we can also consciously cultivate the quality, of compassion, of wisdom in our life. I mean, there's a formal compassion practice very similar to the metta practice that we were doing. But even aside from that, just tuning into this quality of sometimes bodhicitta, this practice for the awakening of all beings, sometimes referred to as the noble heart, the awakened heart. But even without that vast aspiration, simply through our sincere moment-to-moment mindfulness practice, our simple practice of kind-hearted awareness, this total being with whatever's occurring now, in all the different ways we've been talking about, this actually is, as well as cultivating the wisdom of recognizing accurately, it's also cultivating compassion, both. So to talk a little about that. His Holiness the Dalai Lama, who of course most of us always look to as, Mr. Compassion, the 16th rebirth. My mind just went. Anyway, the 16th manifestation of compassion. He really does, from everything you hear and see, seems like one of the more compassionate beings on the planet. Talking about how does compassion develop? And he says it develops through deep insight into what suffering is. And guess how we develop deep insight into what suffering is? I'm sorry to tell you, but we already know. This is still him. This arises by focusing, by opening to our own experience. When we can really bring our full-hearted attention to the suffering in our own experience, he says, then the compassion strengthens. As we can be compassionate with our own experience, it strengthens into a sense of empathy, a sense of connectedness with all beings. But it really starts and continues and deepens. Don't have to go looking for some amazing, incredible experience or practice. And it doesn't have to be the most intense, amazing suffering in the world. When you're sitting and you're just so sleepy and filled with aversion that you want to just beat your head against the wall, and you hate everybody and everything, and if you had to explain to someone what's the problem, and you said, well, I'm sleepy, you know, you can't really feel good about, oh, my suffering is that I'm sleepy. Yeah, compare that to Syria, you know, okay. And then we try to, you know, push away. It doesn't count. But whatever the suffering is, whatever the difficulty is, the quality of the heart-mind meeting with full-hearted, tender awareness, that is actually the cultivation, the practice of compassion. Where else can we start? It's why the difficult times in a retreat, just to come back to retreat practice, they're not something that's in the way. They are the practice. And in a lot of times, I would say, sometimes the difficult times, when I look back over my practice, have been the times when the most insight was really learned. But you don't see that till later. You don't get to be in the middle of it and go, oh, God, I hate this. I can see how much insight I'm having. It's great. Oh, God, this has got to end. You know, it doesn't, because then it would be over. But we have to start where we are. And it does naturally strengthen. Have you ever, well, say for myself, notice how when something, a particular experience that I've been through, that I've been able at some point to really be with, to open to, through mindfulness, through awareness practice, then when I'm not denying it or afraid to be with it, I can be with that particular aspect of suffering, then you notice you can really be present with somebody else who has that same. If you've felt it in reverse, I know when there was a period years ago when I had some autoimmune disease that one of these, nobody knows what it is or what to do, and 175 people would all want to come and, out of caring, offer you try this, take that, do this exercise, take these pills, you know, go to see this healer, call this psychic. And everyone, you could say well-intentioned, but I could really feel the difference between the people who were caring, but the caring was also like a discomfort with being with the suffering. And so it's subtle, it's caring, but you want to fix it because it's not comfortable to be with the person suffering. Do you know what I mean? And this can be very subtle. I'm not putting it down. I have it too. But then when there's someone who didn't have that, goes, yeah, God, it's really a drag, isn't it? And then they may offer something that they've done. Try, you know, I did this and I did, and it, but it has a different feeling. It doesn't have, I could just feel the sense of the empathy, and that's really compassion, you know? So when you're really not afraid anymore, we don't have to hide from this particular aspect of suffering, it naturally strengthens into empathy with beings. That's just what happens because, again, there's not the sense of separation. And so how we're meeting whatever's arising in your mind-heart experience in this moment, the beautiful, the difficult, the neutral. You recognize the three Vedanas, right? The beautiful, the difficult, the neutral. How the heart-mind, how the awareness is meeting it, that is the practice, that is the cultivation of compassion if we're just meeting it with just pure presence. Whatever's actually arising, sleepiness or fear or disease, that's arising as the result of whatever all the previous causes and conditions are, culminating in how it is in this moment. And in some way, this moment is as it is now. This moment couldn't possibly be any different because it's here. It can't be any different. All the conditions have come together. But how the heart mind is meeting this moment, that's the seed of karma, the seed of intention of that next action. So that's why when we've been really, you know, encouraging in the metta, but now in the vipassana, just this simple face-to-face meeting, just total presence. It's like this now. And you don't see any big result from it. But each moment of that, if it's towards suffering, that's a moment of compassion. Just the pure-hearted presence. That is the cultivation of compassion when it's meeting suffering. Just meeting it face to face. And Pema Chodron. How does our response to suffering and to suffering in ourselves and the world begin to happen? How do our reactive responses change? She says, well, it starts with being willing to feel what we are going through. It starts with being willing to have a compassionate relationship with the parts of ourself that we feel are not worthy of existing on this planet. If we are willing, through our meditation, to be mindful not only of what feels comfortable, but also of what pain feels like, if we even aspire, if we even have the intention to stay awake and open to what we're feeling, to recognize and acknowledge it as best we can in each moment, then something begins to change. That's what we're doing here, right? Moment to moment to moment, something begins to change. And this meeting fully is not only the cultivation of compassion, it's what allows the accurate recognition to recognize there's no intrinsic self-existence. The two naturally go together. One teacher said once, in every moment of activity of body, speech, or mind, we're committing to something. The question is, to what? In every moment of activity, we're committing to something. The question is, to what? That's not like a question to make yourself wrong. It's just, oh, really look. What's going on right now? A few years ago, one of my teachers, Utejaniya, quite some years ago, was going through a difficult time in the monastery where he taught. I don't want to go into it, but a difficult political time, and one of the other monks who was more senior kind of wanted to take the place over. And you might as well get rid of, if you have any ideas, that because someone's a monk or a nun in robes, they're automatically pure. Forget about it. You know, it's just human beings in a different uniform and taking more precepts. So anyway, there can be a lot of weird, nasty monastic politics over there. And so anyway, at this period, this one monk was spreading really, really bad rumors about Utejaniya this monastery is overseen by a lay council, because it comes from his teacher, Shuiyumin. So it's overseen by a lay council. It's not like the abbots own the monastery. And Tejaniya, being more junior, wasn't the abbot anyway. So anyway, there was this time where this monk was really engendering these really nasty, awful rumors, without proof, but there's not much proof. And in Burma, actually, that's the way people get rid of people they don't want in an organization, with rumors. It's really kind of nasty to see. So this was going on a lot. And it was a very difficult time. Not many people were coming. And Utejaniya felt like he couldn't leave because he would have been shoved out. But there were some things, and I was talking with him one day, and there were some things about this other monk that were actually true, that he was doing, that were really harmful. And not just the rumor mill, but other things he did concerning money and other stuff that were breaking the Vinaya and that were really harmful. And I said to Tejaniya, why don't you just at least tell the lay council that this stuff's going on? You don't have to be aversive, but why don't you at least just say that, you know? And he said, no, I don't want to add more unwholesomeness to the situation. So he's really just looking at, you know, his mind, his heart, and what he does, and saying, I really don't want to add more unwholesomeness to this situation. And there's no way he could have gone and said this stuff about this other monk without it really whipping up a whole bunch of akusala, unwholesome, hateful things. So it's interesting. This quality of just really seeing what are we committing our heart and mind to. So this is on the relative level, the level of awareness of the motivation and action in the world. And this is a place now again, I'm going back to this is working consciously with the motivation of non-harming, the motivation of compassion. It wasn't so much that Teju just had compassion for that monk, but for the whole situation, not to bring in more suffering. But again, we can act with as clear an intention as we have of compassion. But again, we are going to keep having to balance it with the wisdom of the vastness, the complexity, the emptiness of life, but also the vastness of life. Because we can have the clearest sense of compassion, but we don't know how that's going to play out, right? Life situations are complex and ambiguous. And Utejaniya had no clue back then what would happen. It really looked as if he was just honoring his sense of goodness and non-harming. But it looked like he didn't have a leg to stand on. It looked like he was going to get, you know, turfed out of the monastery altogether. And actually, that didn't happen. I don't even know. You never really know what's going on over there, ever. But somehow it all turned around, and the lay council came down and checked it out and kind of made the other monk leave, and Tijani became the main. He was already the main teacher. It was all a kind of a pride competition anyway from the other monk. But so they came and they made what seemed to me, to most people, the appropriate decision. But when Utejaniya was saying, I'm not adding more akusala, he didn't know how it would come out. It wasn't like a planned out thing. If I do the right thing, then the right result will come that I want. We don't know that. And so the way the vastness of karuna, the way we can continue to drop into it, to really, you know, commit to that moment to moment, is when we're also holding it in the equanimity of the wisdom of non-self, of emptiness, that we can never ensure the desired results. And this is a really hard thing to know, a hard thing to hold. You know that we can't control outcomes. We can't control other people's responses. You know, we have to try and have as much information as we can about the situation. That's also just relative wisdom in terms of acting from compassion. You need to have as much sense of what's appropriate and what will help. But in many situations, there's no way to have all that information. There wasn't then in Burma. We won't always know. And the world, the conditions are changing. How do we find the equanimity and the strength to continue to, you know, act with compassion, to continue to show up in a really painful situation? It doesn't go the way we want. How do we not turn to negativity or pull back into our separate selves, you know? Because when we open to suffering, well, it goes the other way. Opening to suffering is essential. We can't just open to the beautiful. We can't just open to the beautiful insights and stay shut down to suffering. It doesn't work that way. Opening to one, we open to all. So we open to the suffering. It doesn't go the way we want. We can't just pull back. Well, we can. Just pull back and go forget it. But then that's like, you know, the anemone that shuts down when you touch it, shuts itself off. That's, it didn't go right. I did it wrong. Forget it. I'm not going to try anymore. But this is, again, it's vast and hard. It's part of our whole practice. The example that has always stuck in my mind of this is from years ago I read the autobiography of Sister Chanakong. She's the nun who's been with Thich Nhat Hanh for years and years and years. And I'd known her because I'd been there. She's a real firecracker powerhouse. Anyway, she was talking about when they were still in Vietnam during the Vietnam War, so quite a while ago, and she was a peace activist, which meant that both sides, South and North Vietnamese, didn't trust her or Thich Nhat Hanh. That's why they actually got expelled, because when you're peace activist means you're not taking either side. So at one point she was thrown into jail during this war, and she was in jail in a cell with a lot of other women, including two young girls, like I think they were like 11 and 12, sisters, who had been just in a village, a South Vietnamese village, that when the South Vietnamese army went through, just swept the village and was saying, oh, you're all Viet Cong, and put the two girls in jail. They're just in the wrong place at the wrong time. And there were also in the cell a lot of just criminals and hard women. And so Sister Chan Kong, she was getting out because her family knew the prison director and that kind of thing. So she was getting out and was meeting with the warden of the prison as she was going. She said, oh, well, just let me tell you. So she's filled with compassion. There's these two young girls here who've done nothing, and these hardened criminals, and it's really bad, you know, it's really harmful for them. So compassion and as much wisdom as she had, and the prison warden goes, ah, I see the prisoners are talking to one another. I've got to really tighten up the rules here. I'm glad to know that. And that was it. So she just, her pure intention made things worse for them. How do you live with that, right? If we're taking it personally, if we're thinking that the compassionate intention means it's going to work out, we don't know. We can't know. And then can we stay open? And I will forget it. I'm not trying again because I feel too horrible about what I did, you know, and then beat yourself up. But the equanimity is the compassionate intention was a compassionate intention. She couldn't have more information. How do you stay open? This is where the wisdom of the equanimity of emptiness is essential. You know, and we'll lose this, but we'll come back. In like a present day experience, if you've ever had to be, I don't know what you call it here. In the States, we call it a medical proxy. It means I've had to do it for both my parents and my sister when they're really ill in the hospital and can't make decisions for themselves. And you have to make the decisions of which treatment to do, you know. And the person has made a formal thing that you're their choice to do that. So in the States, then the doctors have to consult with you and they have to listen to you and they have to give you the information, which they don't always. So that's a really even when you've talked to the person through what they want and all the possibilities. My experience in the three times is what actually happened is never exactly what was talked about. Because you just can't think of every possibility. And then the options that are offered, you have to find out what might happen. The doctors don't know because they don't know which way it'll go. And you're trying to figure out, is this what they would want? Because it's not exactly what we talked about. And, you know, I'd had to make the best decision I could and live with it. And stay open, stay connected. And it's just never clear. It's ambiguous. You don't know what will happen. No one can know. The doctors don't know either. And so to have, you know, sometimes I did and sometimes I didn't, right? I mean, I could be there. But sometimes that sense of the tender, open heart staying connected to the ambiguous nature of the situation, making the decision, it doesn't seem like it went so well, and how to stay present with that without going into self-blame or other blame. But just realize this is innumerable conditions coming together in this moment. We can never know ahead of time. So the wisdom of emptiness, the wisdom of compassion, fueling each other. And I think they need each other. We can't. The wisdom and freedom just doesn't come without both of them. But just to end, to come back to, this is just not something we have to think through so much. It's really, I've come to trust it so deeply, just from our moment-to-moment simple practice. If we're really committed to the radical quality of awareness to whatever's occurring, no matter what it is. Not looking for result, not looking for experience, but just, you know, and that's why it may seem like nothing much is happening. Well, we just keep on harping. We just keep nagging you. Just okay. Are you aware of it? You go to hold. Okay, right. Are you aware of it? Okay, all this complicated thing happened. Okay, yeah. Was there awareness there? Great. You know, have you noticed that that tends to be what we say? Oh, wow, this and this. Okay, cool. Was there awareness there? Great. You saw the whole thing. Wonderful. And you're going, huh? You know, but something huge is going on there, because this is both the expression and the deep cultivation of the wisdom and emptiness of non-self and the wisdom of the connectedness of compassion, both, just from the moment-to-moment simple practice of awareness, really, in this radical form. And so this is where it becomes our whole life, you know, like... Who is it? I think it's Ajahn Sumedho. He said, you know, you don't have to have some special kind of suffering. The suffering of your own life is quite enough to be enlightened with, to cultivate compassion with. So we start where we are, right here, when we go home, when someone we love is ill, or when the neighbor's kid is screaming and yelling at 3 a.m, you know, whatever it is. This right here is enough to bring in the fullness of awareness that can open into the wisdom of emptiness and the heart of compassion. There's nothing that's outside of that possibility. No aspect of our life is outside of that possibility. We'll forget it 10 million times, of course. But I hope you've gotten it this week. The awareness is, all we have to do is remember it. You don't have to create it. So just end with this from Pema Chodron. At the relative level, our noble heart is felt as kinship with all beings, kinship being related. At the absolute level, we experience it as groundlessness or open space. And we go back and forth between the two.